Matthew?
Yes.
Mary?
Yes.
Kirby?
Yes.
Robert?
Yes.
Your mission, should you choose to take it on this week, is to keep Deanne listening to the show.
Ah.
I pay paid services in association with Who1.co.uk presents a 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast number 182. I'm Adam, and with me this week is Matthew.
Help me get this top off.
Mary.
Well, not at these temperatures. Besides, it's too warm.
Kirby.
I don't believe that man was made to be controlled by machines.
And Robert.
Yes, and if you'd had your shoes on, my boy, you could have lent her hers.
That's a very strange conversation. This week we'll be looking at the keys of Marinus, amongst hopefully other things. As long as things don't drag on a bit too far like they did last week. And I've just clicked on the wrong blimmin' thing. And some audio message from Ian Kirk has just arrived. Did you hear the little ping ping? That was Ian Kirk's message arriving live on the show. Or lively recorded.
Better than arriving dead.
On the show. Right, so unfortunately I got myself ready apart from the video.
Unfortunately.
We've got to get the video going, so I can't really do much of that. What? So I'm just going to get the video running, so no doubt it won't be muted, so I'll just have to... Oh.
There must be someone
yes,
who can
send
these.
Yes,
it doesn't run too far.
Years, all my friends, all my followers
so
have gone.
So sorry, listeners, you can hear the menu for the film. Right then, the Keys of Marinus starts off with the Doctor Who thing.
It does?
Yeah.
How original.
Really?
It does, yeah. anyway, so basically, a little model TARDIS lands on this sort of model island.
Yeah,
it's so cute. I wonder how big it really is.
Yeah, special effects budget for this episode wasn't particularly large, it's got to be said.
Although, this was the very first time that we saw the TARDIS materialize like that.
And also, it was the first time we had the TARDIS materialize with a handbrake off. Because there was no sound. But yes, obviously this is following on, I would imagine, from Marco Polo, because Ian's sporting his costume from the Marco Polo.
Yeah, Fred was asking me about that. Why is he wearing that? The previous story was set in China. Oh, cool. So,
then some miniature thingamajigs wash up on a shore. Looks like they've probably been pulled by some sort of string.
Actually, they were, and here I go, even though I said earlier that I only watched this thing through once, they were actually being pulled by magnets underneath the water.
Well, there you go.
No!
So the team arrive on the shore. Now, I'll tell you what, right, I'm going to tell you this now. Susan, in this episode, I know it's not Carol Ann Ford's fault, and I know it's one of the reasons she left the show. She was really badly irritating in this story.
Oh, yeah, she was.
She's a time-travelling Time Lord who's seen all sorts of things in the universe, and she's
suddenly
such a scaredy cat, it's ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah, Carol Ann Ford in the commentary comments on that as well, and the fact that she felt pretty much rubbish in her performance in this story.
I'm not blaming her at all, but it does stand out that she's basically there to go, oh, Barbara, give me a cuddle.
Yeah. Oh,
she's
being,
they're treating her like a 7-year-old, really, and it's just ridiculous.
Right.
No offence, Isabella, sorry. So the Doctor goes exploring, and while Susan sort of decides she's going to have a little bit of a paddle. Now, it would have been quite interesting if she'd proceeded with the paddle.
Obviously. Oh, yeah. then she would have had a reason to scream.
That unfortunately brings the first bit of patheticness where she's cuddling up to Barbara's tits. As if it's like she's supposed to be 15, 16. So much like a much younger child. And they've really cocked that up somewhere along the line. And I know I've seen obviously all these stories before, but and she's a bit pathetic sometimes. And in the Reign of Terror, she's understandably afraid because it was a frightening thing. But she wasn't as bad in that as she is in this. You know.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that jumper she's wearing was made by her mother.
I think.
Not by the BBC wardrobe department.
Yeah, you've only watched this once, haven't you, Kirby?
Thank you, Kirby.
Yeah, really. We weren't going to hear much from Kirby today.
Basically, it's a sea of acid, okay? Right, then we see...
Adam.
What?
It's the Sea of Death. Did you not see the on-screen title?
Acid, but we've established it's acidly made of acid.
But the title of the episode was The Sea of Death. It's like,
be quiet! Right, so the strange bloke in a wetsuit tries to undo the lock of the TARDIS. Obviously, that does come out quite easily, as it did in Centaurites at some point. They sorted that out somewhere along the line. And they go and examine slightly larger versions of the little crafts that washed up on the shore.
Those were kind of cool.
They managed to get a bit further onto the shore by the time the Doctor and Ian started poking around at them. They did allude to a rather sort of gory idea that the empty suit inside one of them was empty because the body completely dissolved. I thought there'd be some sort of mush there, to be honest with you. But
alien acid. When those things were coming up on the shore, there was one that had liquid in it.
Yeah.
None of the others showed that, but the one definitely had liquid in it. So it's like,
We did see that. I like that.
Is it the correct one?
Anyway.
Yes, it
Susan
was.
Susan borrows Ian's
boots. The one that was separate, the one that was further from them.
Yeah.
Right.
It was. Susan borrows Ian's boots to go back to the TARDIS to get some replacement shoes for the ones that got dissolved. While they're poking at this empty wetsuit. Or is it a dry suit? I don't know. And then Susan arrives at this tower thing with a drawn corridor in the background, which is great until they move the camera and the perspective goes on it. And again, the walls are a bit mysterious, aren't they? They sort of flip open. You see one of the crew, actually.
rotating the door. Just after 9 minutes.
So brief.
He watched it once.
It's difficult to see it.
Helping to revolve the door.
I'm sure the info text would have said exactly who the crew member was, but I didn't bother.
No, it didn't. It pointed out the crew member, but I saw the crew member when watching it the first time through without the info text.
Yes.
And you can see the shadow of the microphone boom, you know, while they're outside.
And you see a lot of camera shadows in this.
The info text didn't point that out, which surprised me.
Probably because
there's a moment where you can see how small the set is because what you can just see William Russell's leg coming into shot just before the camera, but just before they cut to what is supposed to be another section.
Yes. Yeah.
That was Lime Grove, wasn't it?
There was a lot of things like that.
Yes, it was Lime Grove. I'm still amazed that they filmed these things. They filmed these things the way that they did.
I know.
Basically, in order, almost like a stage play.
Yeah.
In very little time.
Played in live.
Yeah.
And there's also, it's very obvious in this story where they have a shot of somebody walking through a corridor and that starts with them standing still and then starting to walk. That happened quite a lot. I know we talk about wobbly sets. The sets in this were visibly wobbly and very
very, very wobbly.
I
read somewhere someone was trying to say, no, these weren't wobbly. No, I think it was in the little extra thing on the disc from the set designer. He said, no, these weren't wobbly sets, but yes, they were wobbly sets. Sorry.
Yeah, especially when the Vords would trip over them.
But the thing is, I know that the Vord that grabs Susan and gets stabbed from behind. Who the Blumenek stabs him from behind? Because there's a wall there.
I know. That's
I wondered about that.
Weird.
I know.
He wandered about on his back and he was trying to tell Susan, I've got something in my back.
All right. Anyway, right.
Well, Arbiton kind of disappears for a moment and then reappears, so... I got the impression maybe he went and flipped a switch somewhere.
I think there is some very, is very gappy this, and I think it might be because there's missing scenes from it.
No, well, the script was put together in a hurry because this replaced not one but two different scripts. Mm-hmm. This slot was originally supposed to be taken up by Anthony Coburn's The Masters of Luxor, which was supposed to be the second ever story that got replaced by the Daleks. And in fact, both times it should have been produced, it got replaced by Terry Nation scripts. And then there was a script by Malcolm Hulk called The Hidden Planet. I think it was by Malcolm Hulk. Was dropped at the last minute, and then this was written in a hurry and put in. So that might
That's
explain
what she said.
Oh, for goodness sake. Anyway.
Yeah, I opened myself up to that. Oh, that's what she said.
Yeah.
Anyway, Matthew, every sentence is a possibility.
if you're not careful what you say it is, yes. Anyway, so a little 5-inch action figure falls into a little acid thing.
I know.
Is some of the actors in this are very posh and irritatingly so. The bloke who plays Arbitan is one of them. It's very posh, very annoying. And there's some other actors later on in the story that are talking
and
in a very
posh way. The entire civilization of this planet did not make sense.
No, that's true. Yeah. And also, it didn't make sense that they were talking about things like... I think Barbara later on in the story mentioned about something below the Earth, but they're not on Earth. And there was mentioned
humans,
and they can't be humans.
Voids are referred to as humans, and they're not human.
Exactly. So,
and the way the doctor says, I'll see you in 3 hours or something, and what, is it Earth hours, or do they have hours there?
Indeed. But there you go. Moving on, so the Doctor and that meet up with Arbitan, and Arbitan rather randomly decides that they're going to get the keys, which is quite funny in a way they're talking. He does explain a little bit about, the history of their planet, Marinus. And then suddenly decides, you must get the keys, in that sort of stupid posh voice. So they decide, we're not going to do that.
Adam, be nice to Doctor Who's one brush with Citizen Kane, please.
All right. Never mind.
Oh, that's right. Harry. One of these guys was in Orson Welles' group.
Yeah, which George Koleos, who plays Arbitan.
Oh, okay.
Was in Citizen Kane. He was the lawyer whose memoirs the reporter at the beginning of Citizen Kane consults first.
Right.
Yeah, so they go back to the TARDIS, and a very pathetically acted sort of force field is around the machine. They're sort of each member of the crew is in a slightly different position. Yeah, go on, Mary. You're going to ask me a question.
I have a question. If Arbitan is so able to throw up a force field to keep them in, why couldn't he have thrown up a force field to keep the boards out?
Yes, and also, why can you put the force field around the doors of the place where they were at, rather than making them walk all the way back to the TARDIS? I hadn't considered that one, but yes. Yeah, so it was a rubbish poor force field, really. Rubbishly acted force field, but I suspect this is probably one of the first...
story, so...
I suspect it's probably one of the first force fields ever to be in any science fiction thing up to this point, so... of course, this is before Star Trek, and after this, force fields were in Star Trek, so it proves that Doctor Who...
Was it very far ahead of Star Trek? Star Trek was only a year later.
Nevertheless, it was. Now, the effect of them using the time dials... travel dials, whatever they're called. What were they called again?
Travel dials. Apparently the time agents got that technology later on.
Yes, indeed. Now, they...
I couldn't help but think of Terry Nation's later series, Blake 7, which also featured similar devices.
Yeah.
Yep, indeed. So they had to step into a dark piece of scenery to use them, for obvious reasons. but I thought that was quite a good effect in some ways.
Except once that they use them, you can see their shadows as they walk away.
Yes. Yes, and then Arbitan gets done. Yes, Robert.
Cora McElhaney just says, I tried to send it about the feedback, but it comes back to me like last week saying the attachments is too large. It is only around 20 megabyte. I just got off my third sleep shift.
I think the maximum on the email is usually around about 10 megabytes, isn't it?
It depends on your email service, actually.
Yes, I can't resolve that one, but bear with me. I'm going to have to Sorry, just watching our Arbitan rather pathetically get killed. Right, and I'm just going to change the film for the little thing with the slightly wavy blondie hair.
The kid.
Right, come on up. What film do you want on now, then? Well, you're going to have the sequel. Well, it doesn't matter. Just choose something.
How frustrating. You want to express your opinion.
Texas
and...
Chainsaw Massacre. Okay. We'll put that on, yeah?
All right.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. How about Friday the 13th? Hey, that's a good one.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Can you choose something, please? Oh, The Exorcist. Do you want to watch The Exorcist?
Somebody won't be sleeping tonight.
You know, it's funny that in 1963, what I read is that this was very scary to children, this Keys of Marinus. Can you imagine nowadays they have to watch things like The Exorcist to be scared?
I don't think a Vord would scare me.
Well, I don't know. It said kids were scared by the Vords.
A scuba diver with a funny helmet.
Well, you know, I don't know if little kids have that kind of critical facility.
Looks like it. Well, you know, they're like proto Cybermen as well, if you think about it, with, you know, the wetsuits and the thing on the head.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Revenge style.
They look tall, dark, and threatening, yeah.
Well, I'm only thinking of that.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, Isabella. Hello, Isabella.
Hello, sweetie.
How are you going?
I'm fine.
Is your daddy putting a movie in for you?
Yes.
Which one is it?
Yeah, Exorcist?
No.
Friday the 13th?
Yes.
Yes! Oh, I'm having a word with your mum.
Yeah, that's an awfully scary movie.
I'm not scared.
Oh, well, good for you. I'd be scared.
Huh? You'll be scared.
Yeah, I would be scared. Friday the 13th is very scary.
I love
even for
scared,
grown-ups.
Oh. Dad, I didn't know that.
You didn't know what?
That's for grown-ups.
Are they really being sort of taken in by my elaborate con about you watching an adult scary film? I think they were, you know, because they're going and saying
scared.
How to completely taken in by it, weren't they? What are you actually watching?
Well, I'm actually watching All Stars.
Yeah, they won't know
All
what
Stars?
That is.
What's that?
All Stars? What?
It's like a street dance film.
So not Friday the 13th.
Well, Isabella
so
told us it was.
Isabella? The word you're looking for is yes.
Yes.
Right. Come on, off you go.
Bye.
Bye, Isabella.
See ya.
By the way, that was Isabella Pearson, brought to you by Deanne. Thank you, Deanne, for recommending we have things like that on the show. Right.
I agree.
Okay, right, here we go. So the next episode begins with, because obviously last episode ended with them travelling to a mysterious place and Barbara's disappeared. And where is she? There's blood on her travel dial. Now, the next bit, of course, find...
pathetic, isn't it?
Well, let me
It was her travel dial was needed by a blue-skinned guy because he must have cut it off of the wrist of a time agent.
Okay, anyway. So... But she did get the travel dial back. So, let me speak. So, they turn up in some luxury sort of surroundings where they're being, you know, waited on hand and foot. It was very, very nice and obviously not quite what it seemed to be. And then they sort of go to... Well, Susan, again, pathetic, falls asleep and has to be sort of walked
idiot
to a bed. And they all decide... But then some strange sound plays... She places something on their foreheads and stupidly Barbara's falls off and then overnight she can
see. Isn't it amazing how quickly Barbara was able to change clothes?
Yeah, if these were done in sequence, that makes what follows, you know, very interesting.
So anyway, she wakes up and tries to convince the doctor and Ian that all is not quite what it seems to be, that what they're actually in a, well, very grotty place.
Yeah, this was a very interesting episode with yes. those two different viewpoints.
Sabitha yeah. Gets punished for failing to stick the thing on Barbara's head properly. The doctor gets a laboratory. laboratory with a particularly.
I like that. I like the laboratory.
Particularly yes. interesting mug. And then we meet the three brains. Was it four brains in the jar? Wasn't it?
Oh, but I like how Barbara, who hides behind that very shallow column and can be seen by everybody.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
yes, I saw that.
They do that a lot in Doctor Who.
It was pathetic. I mean, he must have been able to see
behind it. There.
Yeah, I'll just look one direction here. Because the one thing I want to look for is actually quite plainly in front of my eyes.
That's yeah. right.
Yeah, so
idiot.
But she does get seen and captured and taken to the little brains by Ian,
brains.
Funny enough. Now
brains.
There was a Star Trek story involving brains in jars, I believe. Again, nicking ideas. Right, so yeah, now Barbara then decides to have a fight with Ian and wins. Whether Ian's such an amazing, you know, warrior gets oh, yeah. beaten by a girl quite easily, and then she smashes pathetically. Don't know what she's smashing.
She's like going in between the jars.
Did she accidentally get one of them? I don't know. It's anyway, yeah. to cut a long story short, they're easily defeated.
They comment on the commentary that she was told not to break the jars.
They comment on the commentary.
They comment on commentary? Really?
Cool.
Comment in the commentary.
Stop picking on Matthew again.
Why not?
It's 6:30 in the morning. Give me a break.
Yes. No, it's 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, shut up going on about the time.
Night.
So anyway, because the brains are destroyed, is it Altos? Hey. He's suddenly not back to normal, and they get joined by him and Sabitha, and Susan disappears and has another sort of funny turn. Mm. Just to end the episode. And then, of course, they all turn up and Susan very quickly recovers and they go in. They decide to split up. That's right. The doctor decides because they want to find all the keys a bit.
Yeah, what a good plan.
It was quite a good plan.
Yeah, really.
So they can find the keys a bit quicker and not drag it out to an 8-part story.
Because every time we do, somebody gets in trouble.
So he can have an episode off as well, which is quite useful.
Yeah.
Two episodes.
Yeah. Good Lord.
And we're absolutely sure that we can that the people who stay behind can find the keys, or that the person who goes ahead can find the keys. We all know we can find them.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt whatsoever.
So anyway, they all split
and he
up.
He was probably given the instruction to go sit down and learn your lines.
Yes, he was. He was a bit. He was a bit bad on that front, wasn't he? But he did get through it eventually. Now,
it didn't work.
Barbara goes off to have a little investigate of some sort
Let's
of area
the
in the jungle.
Doctor can learn his lines yeah, at right. age.
We're talking over each other again.
Yes. Yeah. Very naughty. Point deductive for Sorry. Kirby yeah. for the quiz. Well, hang on, let's get to the place.
It doesn't matter. I'm going to lose. I'm going to be the worst one. So fine.
Yes, basically. So she goes through into this little area of the jungle. This is Barbara. Now, what annoyed me about this bit, Susan calls her about 3 or 4 times. She must have been able to hear her. She's got a very
She can
loud
see her.
Screechy.
She can well, see
that,
her.
I'll allow that. But she was calling Barbara, Barbara. And she completely yeah. blanked her. And I thought that was very rude and ignorant. And that teacher, this is clearly a children's story. This stands out quite strongly that this wasn't set as a family story or an adult story. It was made for children because it was so, mm-hmm.
You know what was even stupider, though? How Ian and Altos, they go off to try and find another way in, whereas clearly Barbara can get through so easily by just pushing aside. I think that's pretty pathetic as well.
Yeah, there's anyway, so... Yes, I thought that setting children a bad example by somebody's calling out and you don't answer them. So, yeah. So I think this is a point where Barbara finds the key in the crap idol's mouth.
The one with the human arms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And the ridiculous sound effect that was used for the arms moving. So she gets grabbed. And another rotating wall. Did they only have rotating walls for this particular
story?
Yeah, I think that's just a thing they decided. And somewhere along the line, the others decide to move on to the next part while Ian and Barbara try and search for the real key. Then this got a bit confusing. So Ian goes off to try and find an iron bar for a door which is supposed to be solid, which every time it gets touched wobbles like the old fence in my back garden.
Yeah.
And the vines start moving, which is fine. And then the door's open and Barbara calls again. And Ian's just sat there poking at the end of the bar for no apparent reason. Oh, there's a bit of dirt at the end of this bar, I'll just have a quick poke at it. Instead of bringing it along... and then she's inside, and this ceiling's coming down with some very wobbly, pointy things on it.
Oh, didn't that look pathetic?
It didn't look at all dangerous.
And this is the other actor that talks very posh and very irritatingly.
The old man.
Yeah, terrible. Yeah. Not saying he's a bad actor, but the voice he used for the part was awful. Probably his own, but just irritating.
That line of he dies was ridiculous as well.
Yeah, well, it's strange.
Yeah.
Now, he's taken, he takes the dial, doesn't he, as proof that she's who she is. And then she does eventually mysteriously get it back.
Because you don't even see her finding it anywhere. She just suddenly has it on her.
Now, that's the bit that was really gappy because I know, he goes out to the corridor, Ian turns up, and then suddenly he's got a vine around his neck and Ian rescues him, but yet he still dies. Mm.
Yeah, the actor playing Darius, who Adam was just criticizing, is Edmund Warwick, who doubled for William Hartnell in The Dalek Invasion of Earth in The Chase.
Unsuccessfully. Anyway, did you see the on the safe, the very badly created sort of dial?
Yes.
they could have done better with that. You could see people standing in the background as well, crew members and some. There was a thing in the background of... You know, whether the plants were pushing through the walls.
Oh,
The waving paper walls. You could actually see men standing there waving them, which is quite sad.
Yeah. Well, the only reason you're probably seeing that now, which you wouldn't have seen in 1964, is that, it's been vid-fired, it's been cleaned up, and you're watching it presumably on a HD TV screen,
I'm watching on a Macintosh screen, but yes.
I'm watching it on a computer monitor. So,
okay. Which is still even a computer monitor still has a lot better resolution than a 1964 TV would have even.
Too bad this story. It's too bad this story didn't have a good resolution.
Well, can I just say just an affectionate criticism. I don't expect that. You know, that's fine. What you're saying is a really good argument. I'm not going to say that's a bad thing about the story. It's just something you can see. Because obviously they've done an extremely good job in clearing up the picture. So Barbara then. Basically, another pathetic thing. As soon as they turn up in this icy area, they suddenly all can't move. They're so cold that quickly that they fall over and you know.
Ian is in a silk top.
Yeah.
And.
But they get rescued by the beardy man and his
Red Sister Wolf,
who is clearly a rapist because the way he was with Barbara.
This makes me wonder about it being a show for kids. Cause...
It's supposed to be. It's clearly a kid's story, the way it's written and acted.
We're bringing some pretty brutal themes in here on this one.
You know, they mentioned...
Altos being put out for wolf food and Barbara being threatened by a rapist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, go on there, Matthew.
Hold on a second. Trying to gather my thoughts.
I don't think necessarily kids would have noticed the rapist part.
Maybe not.
Clayton
Hickman mentions that, who moderated the former editor of Doctor Who magazine, who moderates the commentary, mentioned that as well, that it's going into very adult territory, and everybody else on the commentary sort of like, we didn't think about that at the time.
Really?
Yeah. But it was
the innocent days of 1964.
Mm. Yeah.
Innocent?
So anyway... Ian initially is unconscious, but when he finds out that his friends might be out in the cold, he very quickly is recovered and goes straight back out into the cold in much similar costume than he did when he fainted very quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, recover from his frostbite fast.
Yeah. And he finds Altos, who should technically be dead, considering how long he's been out. Yes.
Really? Yeah, I mean, Altos has fewer clothes on than Ian does.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way he's rubbing his leg, too.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Also, he doesn't wrap his limited animal skin around the front of his body. He just has it over his shoulders. So surely that's going to make a difference, isn't it? And then, of course, they cut to Sabitha and Susan, and Susan still being pathetic in the polythene, apparently icy, but clearly polythene. Like you say, in 1963, it probably would have looked a bit more icy, but we can see quite clearly in the modern picture that it
flutters when people walk by.
But,
and Sabitha, too.
I didn't think it looked
that bad. She has, no protection against the cold, and yet she doesn't even act cold for that whole...
But she does say, we've got to go back out into the cold, dressed like this. At least there was a reference to how they were dressed. But where they were would have been just as cold to a certain degree. Because Ian comes back and rescues Barbara, doesn't he? Just in time, just before she gets raped. And then forces Beardy Man to take them to the worst ever ravine. Or what they call those cracks in ice? What are they called? Not ravines.
Chasm?
Crevices.
Chasm?
Is it crevices? The worst crevice ever.
Yes.
With the worst rope bridge ever, and the most pointless one at that, actually, because they could have just literally stepped across it, even though they said they couldn't. Again, limitations of whatever, but it was pretty bad, wasn't it? Because the camera pans across the actual gap.
We are complaining so much about this story. It was number, one on the Mighty 200, it was number 160. And I think that it belongs way further down.
Okay, we'll talk about that later.
So anyway, agree with you.
What's her name? Susan and Sabitha go across the bridge and then walk into a room with some sort of iced up soldiers. We don't see them initially, but that scares Susan again. Yeah, that scares Susan again. And of course, they're the demons that the Beardy Man is scared of. And he said, "Oh, you must let me."
No, we're doing the demons in a few weeks.
Shut up. And then, stupidly and rather transparently, Ian traipses very quickly and wobbly across the rope bridge. And then the other end gets undone. And then very theatrically thrown down instead of just let go. He has to throw it across. It wouldn't have made any difference. It would have ended up where it was anyway. And then Ian, he's a good actor, though, isn't he, William Russell? He's so annoyed with himself. I quite love the way he portrayed that aspect
of it. He was the best part of this entire story.
Yeah, I agree. He was.
He definitely was. I thought Barbara was very good too. I thought they were all quite good. They did what their job was, she wasn't her acting. That's how she was told to act. So, and she did.
The direction.
It's just the character. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, they find the key in a block of ice. And conveniently, there's some pipes with hot water running through them.
Yes.
Just sticking right up out of the ground.
which is so hot. In fact, they warm the whole cave up enough for the soldiers to start melting. Meanwhile, they decide to use some giant tusks.
That's
my lovely wife.
I
thought those were supposed to be icicles.
Yeah, I thought they were which mystified me with everything warming up and melting like it was, how they still had those doors.
They could have been stalactites.
Yeah, never mind what they were. I was being a bit facetious.
The transcript I'm looking at lists them as logs.
Oh, no, not the transcript.
Logs?
Were they logs? I don't think they were logs, actually. But anyway.
They didn't look like logs.
They treated them like logs.
Right. And I like the way they look around. They look around that ice cave. It's all ice and rock, and Ian is saying, "Well, let's find some timber."
Yeah, exactly. But that was a bit misleading, wasn't it?
Find timber in a cave.
Yeah, it's a tree over there. Yes,
that's one of the reasons why I don't like the Chickatoya.net transcripts. I doubt that that's what the script really said.
Yeah, okay, never mind. Hang on, I've got to shut doors because they've left two doors open and the film from the other room is getting through, so it won't be a sec.
Bill? He still uses film technology?
can't you hear the reels clicking?
Okay, They do actually decide to use these, or they create this bridge with these, whatever they are, and they get across. It's a bit boring. I'm not going to elaborate on how they got across. Put the bridge back up.
I read somewhere that Susan had a really hard time getting across because she was truly scared because in the rehearsal she had fallen off once.
Yeah. Now I think one of the soldiers falls down the crevasse, or whatever you call it. Again, Ian
does
the
theatrical. Did you like the acting of these guys?
No. Ian throws thing down dramatically.
The soldiers, when the guy falls over and their acting is pathetic.
Yes.
Yeah. They can't say it. They just,
I know, but they still got across anyway, because obviously when they arrive back at the cave, at the hut, the beardy man gets stabbed through the back again. Again, they've used the same type of death with a sword.
Yeah.
And then Ian ends up in a vault and gets a bash on the head. With a very transparent "who did it" person. No, it wasn't actually him, was it? But I thought all along it was him. You know, the bloke who was sat there interviewing him in the room.
I quite like the
idea of you're innocent, you're guilty until proved innocent aspect of it.
Yeah.
I think that was used in Star Trek as well. Voyager, they used that in there. So I think Doctor Who's very... good at being the first
pioneer.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you, Robert.
Apparently, in English law, the burden of proof lies on the prosecution. The accused is innocent until proven guilty.
Correct.
Now, the lawyer. No. Apparently, the whole business. Well, that's the way it is here too. The whole business. In the first episode of Blake 7, I believe they had something very similar.
Yeah, and it also calls to mind a few months ago I read historian Robert Conquest's book, The Great Terror, about the Stalinist purges, and which presented a view of that entire era. And the way it describes the Stalinist show trials were very much in the same respects, that people were brought into the trials presumed guilty, and it was up to them to prove themselves innocent if they hadn't already been tortured into admitting crimes that they hadn't committed.
Mm. Sounds like Guantanamo Bay, does it?
Anyway, but this episode is actually really good. I quite like this episode of the story. I quite like the way
Problems with this episode because it was so the civilizations on this planet are just so
weird,
strangely disconnected.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, true.
I wonder how it all fits together.
I did get the feeling they were traveling for different societies and planets, actually. But yeah, you're right. I agree with that. But I did quite enjoy this episode. I thought it was quite good. I quite liked their telephone. I thought it was quite an interesting idea of a telephone, a communication device.
They didn't coach some of the actors properly. Mm. Some of them held it away from their ears the way that's kind of
like
cool.
Like a microphone.
Yeah.
But some of them held it like a telephone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They should have coached the actors. Everyone use your own standard device you use every day the same way, please.
Yeah.
They should have done that. But anyway.
They would do that nowadays.
Ian is constantly threatened with death. But the way they all work together to save him, it works really well. I quite like that. And Susan isn't too bad in this episode either. Probably because they've wrapped some tape around her mouth for a short while.
Yeah.
That's the next episode, Kirby.
Then they're back on Marinus, the capital of Marinus, I suppose, where Arbitan, who got killed in the first episode, is now discovered to be killed by some weirdo. And yes,
Yartek.
Yeah, and then they drag out Yartek. The ending a little bit. There's a big explosion because they've got the fake key. They put the fake key in there.
Now, wasn't that device the whole thing where the keys fit in the exact same thing from the invasion?
I don't know. It could be.
I wouldn't know.
I don't think so either. It looked a bit different. If you
they could
me.
Have done that in those days, because nobody would have remembered it. So, my bloody.
Well, they used the helmets from the Green Death in a number of Doctor Who's.
Yeah. Okay. And in the first episode of, is it the first or second episode of the TV version of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well?
Yes.
I don't know. But that essentially is that. Now, before, obviously, I tend to have the first go at what I think of stories. There's lots of poor bits about this particular adventure.
Never.
What I think is, I actually quite enjoy the story. I just think they executed it really badly.
Yes.
This is why I will watch this over and over again, if needs be, quite happily, unlike the Sensorites, unlike the Web Planet. it's got lots of different places to go to, little mini stories within a main story. So I quite enjoy it. I just think that I'm looking at it critically, and you can see lots of things to criticise about it. But if I was just sat down and watching it, I'd sort of be slightly irritated by Susan, slightly irritated by this and that. But on the whole, enjoy the story. And that's what I think of this one. It is actually one of my favourite Hartnell stories. I just wish they could have... And they have done better jobs. Like, look at the Aztecs, and that's made around the same time. Brilliant.
Yes.
You know.
It was the next story after this.
Yeah, I think it's the next story. Yes. Yeah.
I've seen a reconstruction of Marco Polo, again, really well done. I just cocked it up with this one on the production side of things. And I think Terry Nation's script wasn't the best. But I do quite enjoy it. I've got an order of players in the quiz who's going to do their remarks on it. Matthew.
Well, I promise this
go
week.
Should I go and put the kettle on?
Well, yes, please. Well, I'll have a wipe.
Well, I was fixing to say that I do promise I will not have a 10-minute rant this week.
You said that last week.
It wasn't a rant. You had perfectly valid things to say last week.
Exactly.
It was fine.
It was. It just went on a little bit too long, but it was.
Oh,
it
just
was,
call it what it is. It was a rant.
Your points were valid and interesting. And
yes,
well done. So carry on.
Oh, thank you very much. This actually is one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Hartnell stories. And while I acknowledge a lot of the faults that
I disagree,
you talked over him. Another point deducted.
I acknowledge the faults of this. I acknowledge that Terry Nation's script, having been written in a hurry, does lack in the characterization department. Very strongly in that not necessarily the greatest actors Doctor Who has ever had. And there's issues with the production design as well, because as Raymond Cusick points out in the feature on the DVD, he was having to put these sets together in a hurry. Yeah. And also, unlike your standard Doctor Who story, where you'd have two or three sets where you basically set the entire story, he was having to come up with brand new sets every week. So I think that explains some of the faults. That being said, the reason it is one of my favorite Hartnell stories is the fact that it is very episodic. It's constantly changing locations. And I do wonder if Terry Nation was perhaps playing being that he came from an action adventure series background. He worked on The Saint and The Avengers and various series like that. And I think The Persuader.
Tony Hancock.
Yeah. And that as well. That to a certain extent, he's paying homage particularly to Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days, which very much along these styles, and it had been turned into a very successful and very popular feature film just a few years before. So, as I said, I acknowledge the faults, but I do very much enjoy the story, and I think that Terry Nation, to a certain extent, is paying homage to going back to the roots of Doctor Who and the action-adventure formatting anyways.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. Mary?
Yeah, in spite of all the faults, and of course, I think the thing that bothered me the most is Hartnell fluffing his lines, which are only made more obvious because he does the actor's mistake. And I'm sorry, Reese isn't here to speak on this, but when an actor fluffs a line, the worst thing you can do is go back and say your line over again, which is what he would do in this story several times. Just like you said, I can't imagine at the moment, I can't prove it at this very moment, you know, and it's like, okay, we know you fluffed that one now. But taking it in context back to 1964, what I read about, because I don't know since I haven't seen them in sequence, is that this was the first time that Doctor Who didn't do a historical, but did more of a sci-fi by going to another planet and all that, which, no?
The Daleks.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. The very first story took them to Skaro. Not the
ironically,
first story.
Ironically, both written by Terry Nation.
Yeah.
Okay, but this whole concept of, you know, the sci-fi and different planets and a different place that they arrive at with every episode must have been fascinating to the people at that time. And if it was written for children, well, then all the things that we're criticizing probably went right over their heads. Because I read about how kids at that time were very scared of the Vords, even though, you know, we make fun of them. So it's Doctor Who breaking some new ground, and I appreciate it for that. As even today, you know, we're so used to these fast action, you know, pack a lot of stories into 45 minutes, that at that time they didn't do that. The pace bothers us, but back then apparently it was very exciting. Mm. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you, Mary. Kirby?
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. I completely disagree with Matthew. I'm sorry. This was one of the worst First Doctor stories I have ever seen. I was bored to tears. It was horrible. The first two episodes were pretty good. After that, it was just horrible. I had trouble keeping it. My attention was just not being held at all. Fred didn't even finish it. She made it through the first four stories.
Stories?
Yeah, well, it's essentially stories.
Each episode is like a separate story.
Yeah.
It was just pretty pathetic. I don't see how it made it. Really, if I look at, let me bring up the Mighty 200 list here. I look at stuff on the Mighty 200. I see stuff that is much better than this. And I've seen the Twin Dilemma. I would almost put this below the Twin Dilemma.
I wouldn't say that's an incorrect statement. I don't mind the Twin Dilemma, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Oh, but Kirby, tell us what you really think.
That's what I said. The Twin Dilemma is better than, and yes, I agree. Yeah. Twin Dilemma shouldn't even be on the bottom of the Mighty 200 list.
Yeah.
But that's all I can say. This was horrible.
So you didn't like it then, Kirby?
Did not like it.
Okay. Robert?
And that's one of the reasons why I really didn't take the time to try to rewatch with commentary. And I've got Infotext playing on it now. And it looks, that would be interesting to watch this with Infotext, maybe. But I'm not sure if I'm...
Something, Kirby.
Yeah.
Watching something with Infotext sometimes makes it a bit more interesting.
I'm not sure
Not for me.
I'm not sure I would... I'm wondering why I got this one other than to review it.
It's about the story.
This is going to sit on my shelf, and I may never watch it again.
I think I might watch it again. I've never watched it with commentary, and I've never watched it with infotext. I like it anyway, so I've already admitted this. So I think Robert's turn is approaching us.
Yes, I think I'm done.
Well, I actually read the novel back in the 80s, and I thought from reading it sounded very interesting. I thought, this is really good. But actually watching it again, as Kirby was saying about watching the infotext, when I watched this, when I got it on DVD, I watched it with the infotext, and it did seem a bit more interesting than it did as I watched it now without the infotext. The budget was, I think, wouldn't go for what it was. I think it's like a prototype Key to Time season, and it's interesting that we're doing the Stones of Blood next week. But really, the Key to Time works better because each story has its own budget, whereas this was a story that, you know, just couldn't sustain itself budget-wise over the episodes. But I did like little things like when Hartnell was saying to Susan and Barbara about Susan
saying, yes, and if you'd had your shoes on, my boy, you could have lent her hers. And you can clearly see Ian and Barbara. Well, their names.
Jacqueline Hill and William Russell.
Yeah, you can see them laughing at his fluff. And it's just so funny to see little things like that go on. I think just adds to it. But
so you're saying it's so boring that what makes it interesting are the mistakes and all that.
Yes. I think it would have worked maybe with a better budget, but as you see, it looks so cheap. And you know, Ray Cusick in the thing right at the end of the interview that he has on the DVD after the credits, he says, "Do you have anything nice to say about it or anything positive?" And he just clearly says no. And it just shows. Just didn't have the money spent on it, and just shows. But it had a lot of promise. And Hartnell, when he returned from his holiday, he clearly relished the role as a lawyer. That was a delight to see. You can see he really enjoyed that and threw his energies into that. He was something that he really enjoyed. I think he likes that heroic role where he's sort of like center stage. So that was a nice performance aspect that I enjoyed. And did anybody notice Fiona Walker, who played, I forget the act, you know, the one who
she was the wife, wasn't she?
She was.
Yeah, and who she later played Lady Painful, was it, in Silver Nemesis?
Penfort in Silver Nemesis, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Echo. Oh, that's where
Echo.
I've seen her.
Echo.
I haven't seen Silver Nemesis.
Okay.
So what?
Are you done, Robert?
No, I was just going to say, when I first saw her in this, I thought, her acting is absolutely pathetic. But I don't know whether it's because she's better as Lady Painful, put it that way.
Okay, well, she was 25 years older when she did that role. That.
Precisely.
Yeah. So, John Gorney. Sorry.
Carry on.
I was just going to say, another thing I did like was that aspect of the changing what Barbara saw in that area in the second episode.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the second episode? As compared to what, you know, this opulent area that everybody else was seeing. I did like the way that they handled that. That was pretty.
Yeah, that was probably the best. That was the best episode of these six episodes.
I agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was that the one I said the best episode?
I don't know.
Yeah. By the way, I keep hearing interesting grunts coming from Matthew's way. I don't think he's happy that we don't like the story.
Okay. Well, let's move on. We've all had our say.
Yeah, I acknowledge, as I said, this is one of my favorite. This is one of my favorite Hartnell stories. It is not Hartnell's best story at all, let me just say. But I don't think something necessarily has to be the best of an era or the best of a series for it to be a bit of a favorite. And also to go back, you know, this was the fifth story Doctor Who ever did. And the Hartnell era in particular is one of a lot of experimentation of Verity Lambert and her script editors pushing the boundaries of what they could do. And sometimes it works brilliantly, and sometimes it falls flat on its face, Web Planet. Yeah. And sometimes you get stories kind of in between. And I think this is one of the ones that fell in between. Yes, it would have worked a whole lot better with the budget, but the budget was, I think, clearly being spent on the two stories on either side of this, the historical, Marco Polo in particular.
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
I'm almost willing to say when I see the Web Planet, I'm probably going to like it better than this.
Nope, not me. You're going to the stage where I'm going to be editing stuff out in a minute. I think we've banged this with a sledgehammer quite hard now. That's what she said. I'm with Matthew, but I think we're sort of even on it, really, aren't we? Well, not really, because it's two against three. So I think it's.
Hey!
You're on the
I
fence.
I did like some things of it.
Okay. Well,
I liked the second episode. It was great.
That's great.
And I'm 50-50 on it. I don't hate it.
Censor rights and Web Planet are worse.
Yes, I'd go.
And the chase. The chase.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. Thank you. That's Akiza Marinus, everyone, who managed to just about finish it off within an hour. Right, we have some various quantities of emails and stuff to get through. I've not listened to Dr. Phil's stuff as yet, but he sent a couple of things in. One is the first thing he sent in was this one, which I haven't played yet. It's a rebuttal for ambassadors. So it goes something like this.
Hey, Dr. Phil here in my usual place, my car.
Watch out for the squirrel.
Heading in between concerts, but I wanted to send in a little bit of feedback way back in the 20 megabyte oeuvre. Comments, because I was listening recently, because I'm behind, to your Masters of Death episode. And there was a lot of commentary about... you know, about certain cues being inappropriate for certain things in the episode. It's a very one thing that I think everyone forgets is that Series 7 of Doctor Who, Pertwee's first year, is the last series where music was done in pre-production because they didn't have the technology or the time enabled to do it in post-production. So the composers would just sit down with the director, with the script, and describe what they wanted, and then go write it, record it, and that's pretty much what you get. I mean, you look at Spearhead from Space, which I think Dudley Simpson's quite effective in that one. Ambassadors. I don't know. There's some very good cues in there, but I can understand what you mean about the appropriateness of the flute and harpsichord for the unit music. But I think the tune's very catchy.
I like it.
Now, Inferno is very different because it's all stock music. So that's easy to pick and do in post-production because it's already been recorded and it's chosen to go with the scene. It was the following season, Series 8, where it was done in post-production. So just thought that might add a little bit of, perspective on what's going on behind the scenes for that particular series. So anyway... keep up the great commentary. Looking forward to hearing. Oh gosh, I've got 4 episodes to catch up with. Anyway, talk to you guys soon. Bye bye.
Thanks,
Dr. Phil.
Got a bit distracted then because we were looking at Alicia's bank statement. Right, so. No. She earns quite a lot of money. She's just spending too much of it on her friends. I'd say go and tote up how much she's spending on her friends.
Argos?
Never mind Argos. Oh, she bought herself something from Argos.
Oh, yes, she did.
We're talking Doctor Who. Yes, thank you, Dr. Phil. I didn't actually get to hear it then either because of Alicia's back statement. So, right then. Talking of Dr. Phil, he has sent some feedback in relation to the Keys of Marinus, and it goes like this.
Excellent.
About the music, by the way.
Good. No.
Would you want to listen to it?
Yes, it's good. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Norman Fourbrocquet was a writer, critic, pianist, organist, and composer of not only opera, orchestral music, and chamber music, but also of over 500 scores for television and radio. The son of a Bolton textile designer, Kay was born on the 5th of January 1929 in the United Kingdom, and after being mostly self-taught on the piano, he worked as a church organist and choirmaster from the age of 14. All this before embarking on his study of music at the Royal Manchester College of Music. It was here where Kay studied composition under Richard Hall and Thomas Pitfield. At the age of 18, Kay was awarded a fellowship to study at the Royal College of Organists. After much persistence upon rejection, he made quite the impression at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden by his instant ability to create an instant piano reduction from the orchestral score to Alan Rawthorne's Wool Ballet, quickly becoming their rehearsal pianist. It was from his work at Covent Garden that allowed him to finance postgraduate studies in composition at the Royal College of Music under Gordon Jacob. In the 1950s, Kay began to receive acclaim for his compositions, including miniature quartet for flute, clarinet, horn, and bassoon. Many of his commissions were through music festivals, including the Passacaglia for Orchestra for Cheltenham in 1965 and the variations for strings for Harrogate in 1966.
It's Cheltenham, by the way.
It was in the 1960s that Kay's relationship with the singer Geraint Evans led to the commission of the cantata King Herod. It was in the 1960s that Kay's relationship with the singer Geraint Evans led to the commission of the cantata King Herod.
Geraint
the Rose
Evans.
Affair of 1968, composed for BBC Television, as well as the 1984 cantata Daniel. Oxford University Press published his variations on the theme of Renaissance composer Michael Pretorius for four violins, two violas, two celli, and double bass with harpsichord. His last concert work was Mr. Pitfield's Pavan, a slow 16th century dance in two, scored for recorder, harp, and strings, and written in the memory of his friend and mentor Thomas Pitfield. His most prolific output remains his music composed for the stage and screen, beginning in 1950 with the Crown Film Unit. In addition to his work on Doctor Who, Kay also composed scores for Out of the Unknown stories, as well as Late Night Horror in 1968. Other incidental music commissions, including the BBC's third program and ITV's Armchair Theatre. In addition to his work at the BBC, Norman Kay also worked for ABC Television and Border Television. Later, he worked at Harlech Television between 1975 and 1987. Kay's music for the BBC drama Song Without Words earned him the Golden Rose of Montreux Prize and the Italia Prize in 1967. Kay was awarded the Salzburg Opera Prize for his television opera Christmas Carol in 1980. Norman Kay also worked extensively as a music critic, working for the Manchester Guardian and later in 1963 for the Daily Telegraph. Writing for many music journals, he also wrote the first British musical study of Soviet composer Dmitri Shostakovich, published by Oxford University Press in 1971. Unfortunately, Norman Kay passed away on the 12th of May in 2001 at the age of 72 from motor neuron disease. Norman Kay's Doctor Who scores to An Unearthly Child, The Keys of Marinus, and The Sensorites are rather similar to each other in many ways. Surprisingly innovative, it's still rather amazing to see that some of the most experimental music in the history of Doctor Who hails from its very first series. Often preferring chamber forces for these scores, Norman Kay employs the flute, bass clarinet, trumpet, often muted, contrabass or double bass, harp, piano, and a variety of percussion instruments. While the second through fourth episodes of An Unearthly Child use a wide variety of pitch drums, bass drum, and timpani, all three scores use keyboard percussion, such as xylophone and vibraphone. The timpani are used quite often with upwards and downward glissandi, tightening and loosening the drum head to cause the pitch to move up and down. Kay includes, albeit briefly in the Keys of Marinus, soprano singing a vocalise as well, meaning song without text.
That's what happens after one of Kirby's jokes.
Or one of yours.
Never.
For fans of the Dudley Simpson era, these scores differ in that there is rarely the presence of bowed strings, save for the occasional double bass, and most often only playing pizzicato plucked anyway. The scores for these stories, in stark contrast to Tristram Cary's electronic score for the Daleks, Serial B Story 2, the majority of the elements are acoustic, although similarly bleak and otherworldly in its affect. The main feature of this music is that, like in the Daleks, is non-thematic, atmospheric, and above all, atonal. Atonality, in the broadest sense, refers to music that lacks a specific tonal center or key, such as C major. Referred to as the emancipation of dissonance, where the hierarchy of pitches, and chord progressions for that matter, are replaced with an equality of pitches, composers as varied as Claude Debussy, Paul Hindemith, Sergei Prokofiev, Alexander Scriabin, Igor Stravinsky, and Edgard Varèse have all written music that has been described, in full or in part, as atonal. The term atonality itself has been seen as somewhat controversial in musical circles. Arnold Schoenberg, whose music is generally used to define the term, was vehemently opposed to it, arguing in 1978 that, quote-unquote, the word atonal could only signify something entirely inconsistent with the nature of tone. Therefore, this brings up many issues that result from composers who use approaches that deviate from traditional tonal chord progressions. Nonetheless, the kind of atonality employed by Norman Kay in his scores for Doctor Who here is referred to as free atonality as opposed to serialism, which organizes the 12 notes in the chromatic scale into a sequence. What we often refer to as a tone row, or referred to as a musical phenomenon, is dodecaphony. Serialism, or dodecaphony, is a compositional technique by which a composer creates unity in an atonal composition by using the 12 notes of the chromatic scale without repeating a pitch until all the others have been used. Serialism was developed because atonality doesn't offer the same sensation of harmonic departure and arrival offered by tonal music, often referred to by musical scholars as the music of the Common Practice period. The Common Practice period often refers to the period from 1600, you know, the birth of opera, to approximately 1900. Significant composers of serial music include those of the Second Viennese School, such as Arnold Schoenberg and his students Anton Webern and Alban Berg, along with composers including Karlheinz Stockhausen, Pierre Boulez, Milton Babbitt, and
others.
Sorry,
can't do anything about it.
Composers who incorporated serialism into their works on a smaller scale include 20th century composers Béla Bartók, Luciano Berio, Benjamin Britten, Aaron Copland, Oliver Messiaen, Alfred Schnittke, Dmitri Shostakovich, as well as Igor Stravinsky. Kay scored One Unearthly Child, especially the first episode, focuses on the low instruments of the bass clarinet, bass drum, and timpani, with chordal accompaniment from the harp and vibraphone performing ostinati, repeated motivic patterns. In contrast to Kay's dissonant score, Susan is listening to John Smith and the Common Men when Ian and Barbara walk in, John Smith being one of the Doctor's aliases, as revealed years later in the series continuity.
APV Services, in association with whoone.co.uk, presents
Nonetheless,
the
piece is actually referred to as Three Guitars Mood 2 by the Arthur Nelson Group, which would later be featured on a compact disc release entitled Doctor Who Space Adventures.
Oh my god.
Yeah, what's going on?
With the score to The Keys of Marinus, Kay also adds the flute to this chamber ensemble, often trilling between notes in sharp dissonance to the accompaniment, as well as using extended techniques such as flutter tonguing, often accompanying the menace of the vord, going against the modern convention of using low-pitched instruments to convey menace. Flutter tonguing is accomplished by performing an isolated alveolar trill like a rolled R while playing. Often notated in scores abbreviated as FLT or FLZ, it's also referred to by the German term Flutterzunge. In addition to flutes, flutter tonguing is most often used on recorders, bassoons, trumpets, and trombones, but can also be employed on other brass instruments and woodwinds. In The Keys of Marinus, the harp is highlighted, in addition to strumming arpeggiated patterns, is most often accompanied by double bass, punctuated by dissonant intervals from the muted trumpets. Adding to the musical ambiguity of the score is the vibraphone, often playing sequences of augmented chords and playing repeated patterns on whole tone scales. Those are scales consisting completely of whole steps. Kay's score to The Sensorites is quite similar to The Keys of Marinus, but does not offer the same return of material to create a sense of continuity as in the previous story. Nonetheless, all these are quite atmospheric and greatly varied in dramatic effect, from the loud and bombastic to the quiet and understated.
Thank you, Dr. Phil. Right.
Yes, thank you, Dr.
Thank you, Dr. Phil.
Or Cyber Leader.
Yes, well, obviously, it won't sound like that on the finished product. I've just deducted a point for Robert for clearly eating during that particular...
Who said I'm eating?
I could hear it quite clearly through Dr. Phil's message there. And did agree a few weeks ago that if you're going to masticate while recording, you mute your microphone, and you've clearly broken that rule.
I'm not eating! You're not now, dinner!
Because you were... It was clearly you, all the way through that particular piece. So
maybe you were hearing
Robert
the same crackling.
Yes. No, it's ridiculous. Right. But anyway, that's great stuff, isn't it? And there's more of that for next week. So I'm looking forward to that. And we have this.
Cool.
If I can get it to work, message from.
Well, before you go on, what is the name?
That was Mary interrupting
you, Ian. By termination.
Okay, we better stop then.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you had started it. What is Dr. Phil's podcast called?
Adventures in Time, Space, and
time,
Music.
Time, Space, and Music.
There's an echo. Right. There's
space,
an echo.
Time, and Music, something like that.
There's an echo. And unfortunately, I can't get Ian's feedback to go back to the beginning now. Blast.
It's Mary's fault.
Right, let's even get that.
Point deducted.
No. Like, can I play it now?
Please.
Hello, 20 Megawatt Podcast. This is Ian Kirk. The Keys of Marinus by Terry Nation. When the first two episodes were broadcast in April 1964, there were only two broadcast network channels in Britain, BBC and ITV. By episode 3, there was a new channel, BBC Two, but it was on UHF, so you needed a new TV aerial to see it. At the beginning, Susan Chu falls into the seawater of Marinus and is marinated. Why could they not smell the acid? The novelisation makes it clear that the Vood are as humanoid as the rest of the planet's people. They wear those helmets to protect them from the mind control machine, even though it's switched off. You can't be too careful where mind control machines are concerned. An idea that has since become popular with conspiracy theorists.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
Vazor, the wolf killer, is played by an actor called Francis DeWolf. Reminds me of Bluto from the Popeye cartoons.
Yes.
I don't see why he would prefer Barbara to Sabitha as his olive oil.
Yeah.
He must have been on that mountain too long. Susan crosses a bridge made of icicles tied together. They don't look much like icicles. Yeah. Susan looks scared. On the commentary, Caroline Ford says she really was scared because she'd fallen off in a previous take. In episode 5, we have CSI Marinus, where a time lord takes part in a trial. My idea got reused a few years later. Yeah. One of the judges has the least convincing beard ever.
Yep.
The legal system is guilty until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose those travel dials had to be left behind at the end of the story, or they would have been very useful later. Perhaps they only work on Marinus. You have to stand in front of a black background to use them. At the end, the Vood leader disguises himself as Arbitan. I think Terry Nation pinched that from Little Red Riding Hood.
Yes.
The whodunit is a bit contrived. There has to be a suitable murder weapon in the museum. It has to be capable of containing the key. I have a password manager program, and I accidentally deleted the entry for Facebook and could not remember my password.
Oh,
as part of the identity verification process, Facebook asked me for the name of one of my Facebook friends. I typed Adam Pearson. He said, that name is too common, try another. I typed Mary Blitz Lang, and that was accepted.
Oh, well, it would be.
Bye for now.
Thank you, Ian. It's not that funny.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't. Yes, brilliant. Sorry, I got slightly distracted there, because I just got a message come through from Simon Fisher Becker. Saying that he'd be very happy to appear on the podcast.
All right.
Excellent. Yeah, Dorian himself.
But he's off to Philadelphia this week and returning on the 12th. So they'll watch this space on that one. Right, and no, we won't be watching an episode with him in. Oh, I suppose we could, but not for review purposes. News. Amazingly, we've got time for news this week.
There's news?
Yes. There's, well, I'm not going to do it in that order. I'm going to do it in the other order. So in fact, we missed out on news last week. No, Corey's feedback didn't make it through. Corey, try and do your audio at a sort of lower resolution so we can get it about 10 megabytes, I think is the most likely to be possible to fit on an email. Or Kirby might be able to PM her another way of getting the feedback through that might work. Hey, Kirby.
Just some sort of thing like Dropbox or something.
Yes, to Dropbox. Yeah, easy enough to do.
Sort something out.
Google Drive works well too, and that's free.
Yeah.
The good advice there from Kirby Bartlett Sloan. Join us next week for next installment of Kirby's computer.
He's already given his lawyer's tips.
Anyway, right. So the Doctor Who Symphonic Spectacular. Which Reese would be particularly enthusiastic about, is going to New Zealand.
Is he going to?
It's just so ironic. We had a good thing about music, and Reese wasn't here to listen to it. So he does pick his moments, doesn't he, for not being on the show.
Reese.
The ratings for the Doctor Who proms was astonishingly 1.2 million viewers. Oh, dear. But I suppose it wasn't Doctor Who, was it?
Yeah, they did post. Somebody posted it on the entire thing on YouTube. I don't know if it was taken down yet, but I watched. I enjoyed this one better.
I watched it. Yeah, I've got it on my
2010 version.
I've got it on my Sky Plus, ready to watch it. In fact, I was going to try and watch it before we recorded, but I didn't get time in the end.
Well, it's worth noting that the low rating may be because it was broadcast. Was it broad? I'm trying to find the news article on the Doctor Who news page. Mm-hmm.
It was a weird time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was broadcast early afternoon, but it did win the ratings for its particular time slot. So,
cool.
Did anyone else watch it?
Terror of the Zygons.
A little of it.
What's that got to do with it? Anyway, right. Sorry, I talked about Robert saying Terror of the Zygons. Right. Audio Go September releases Destiny of the Doctor, which is a Be Quiet, which is a ninth Doctor story, Night of the Whisper, with Nicholas Briggs.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's not a companion. Hmm. All the others have been companions reading it.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. The Ninth Doctor only has so many companions, so if nobody's available for the recording, then you get somebody
it's
else.
It's just unusual. It's a Ninth Doctor story with Nicholas Briggs doing it. So, Trial of the Time Lord, Volume 1, which is, I think, CD collection of novelizations.
It's the audiobooks of the novelizations of... Mysterious Planet and Mind Warp.
Which is essentially what
I just
said.
Did the artwork.
Adam. Alistair Pearson.
Yeah. Mm. He got his copy already of that.
He did. TV episodes, Collection 6, which is six Doctor Adventures starring William Hartnell as the First Doctor, plus extra bonus material. These classic soundtrack adventures with additional linking narration have all been remastered and include bonus interviews with William Russell, Maureen O'Brien, Peter Burvis, and Annika Wills, or as they say on the DWO WhoCast, Anique Wills. right, so Big Finish August releases Starlight Robbery, Alchemists, and Benjamin and Baxter. Now, Big Finish, of course, have got their 50th anniversary episode coming up soon. Looking forward to downloading it because I won't be buying the vinyl.
I am.
You are.
Not the vinyl. No,
Got
the CD. Yeah. The vinyl's like $300 or something. No. Ridiculous.
It's $150, I think, US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still got to pre-order the limited edition version. I've been procrastinating about that for too long.
Do it.
We've got some.
Yeah, I've already purchased it.
Have you? Oh.
The 50th anniversary, the limited, the download.
Oh. Is it on pre-order, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to get it on pre-order.
Yeah.
Sad news. Christopher Burgess, who is in Enemy of the World and Terror of the Zygons and Planet of the Spiders, has passed away at the age of 86. And you could say even sadder because he's 22 years younger, Gerard Murphy, who is, and we talked about Silver Nemesis, played Lady Painful's sidekick, Richard.
Elsa's just too young.
Yeah, very young.
Cancer, yeah. Cancer for 2.5 years.
Very, very sad. And we talked about briefly about the Ice Warriors coming out on DVD. I haven't got to watch it yet. Really looking forward to it if I ever get the chance. And I've still haven't watched my Spearhead from Space
Blu-ray
yet.
Yeah.
What?
Did not hear me. I'll say it again. I still haven't watched my... I forgot what I was going to say.
Did you vote for Spearhead?
Space.
Did you vote for Spearhead, hoping that you could?
I did put it on there deliberately once.
It up,
then it came up in the random. It was very lovely. Very lucky. Anyway, Terror of the Zygons. This is the DVD release.
I can't wait. I haven't seen that since I was... since the 80s.
Later this month.
I really liked it.
It is good.
Did you do it for the show, Kirby? Didn't you comment on it or something?
No, not me.
When it was done on the podcast, I'm sure.
No, I can't remember.
Terror of the Zygons? We didn't do Terror of the Zygons.
Yeah, we've never talked about it.
Never mind.
No, it wasn't when we were all together. It was before we were on the show, but we used to send him feedback, and you were a contributor to that episode.
I've commented before that Terror of the Zygons indirectly made me start watching the show.
Okay. Moving on.
Good.
Scream of the Shalka is due for release on the 16th of September, which I'll be gladly never seen it, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. What did you say, Robert?
I've never seen it either.
Indeed. And the 10th Planet, 18th of November. So they're forthcoming DVD releases. Now, the thing...
There is a piece of DVD news that is briefly covered on the Doctor Who News page, but has been covered in more detail elsewhere.
Oh, yes.
The moon base has been pushed back into November, was originally slated for a November release. It has now been pushed back to 2014 to allow time for the episode's animations to be completed. But the more interesting piece of news is that the Underwater Menace, which the second episode was recently recovered but has not yet been released on DVD, we have just found out the reasoning for that.
Oh, yeah.
Sometime next year, they're going to release the animated version of it with episodes 1 and 4 animated.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Good.
Mm.
Right, the new Doctor Who range. Remember, we talked about my scarf, which was a bit tatty, and I need to get them to replace it for me. That's Lavazzi, who make the reproductions, I suppose. They're doing a... Series 19, is it? The burgundy scarf?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Oh, Series 18, sorry. 18. Yeah.
Oh, 18?
Yeah.
Oh.
Series 18 burgundy Fourth Doctor scarf. I want one. They're also doing the Sixth Doctor's sort of scarf thing, the Paisley thing, and his jumper. The little tank top with the question marks on it. I want them, and I did post on the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast Facebook group, which you can join, listeners, that if you're feeling particularly generous, yes, I'll have them. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's what that was about.
I commented when Matthew posted about as well that he needs to buy several of them so he can wear one every day.
Yes.
I got two of them from a fan-organized run. Yeah, they would wait till 3 years afterwards to decide they're going to officially produce them at probably a lot cheaper of a rate.
I will say I have worn one of those tank tops in the past because Alistair Pearson had one and I borrowed it once for a very short period of time. But yeah, and finally, the 10th Planet script has been found with a different ending. I haven't obviously read this,
but
with no regeneration at the end, so...
Yeah, it's a draft of the script that was apparently dated about a month before the decision was made that Hartnell was going to leave, and has a very different ending.
Oh, he left? Really?
Oh, shut up. So, yes, that's feedback for this week. That's news for this week. By the way, if you want to send in feedback to the show, it's 20mb.feedback@gmail.com. That's 20mb.feedback@gmail.com. And join our Facebook group, the 20 Megabyte Doctor Who Podcast, where we now have 171 members. Unfortunately, two of those are Ian Kirk. So technically, it's... So
it's that big of a man. We need two of them.
I'd like to thank Cora for trying to send him feedback. I'm still intrigued to know what she was going to say. And once again, I'd like to thank Deanne for providing us with a few kicks up the backsides. Because if she fast-forwarded through last week's show, I do hope that hasn't happened this time, because you've missed the special bit where we, if in the middle of the feedback, I'm sorry, the review, wasn't it, that if Deanne happened to be listening to that bit, she got a special prize, wasn't it? I think the special prize was the actual review itself. So you had to actually listen to all of that to really appreciate that. So yeah, please join the group and join in the fun, basically.
It sounds like you're winding down. Are we not going to have
a quiz? No, we are. Be quiet.
I have to step away for just a second. I'll be back.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, me too. I'll be back as
I play some toilet sound effects?
sound effects.
Can I respond to her on air, to her feedback thing and people's comments about me being picked on?
Yes.
I would like to say that I am well aware of the fact that, particularly, I think it was Kirby and Reese last week, their jibes about me having the transcript open and using it on the quiz. I don't use it on the quiz. It's there, and while Kirby has acknowledged that there are major, that it does have issues in it, I use it to keep track of things. Also, I know they're kidding. And as I've said on the Facebook group before, I played quiz stuff when I was in school, and I take this stuff probably a bit too seriously at times, which is why I get annoyed.
Really? Hadn't noticed that at all.
And I know you guys aren't picking on me that badly, and for what it's worth, for the people sticking up for me now, where were you guys 12 to 15 years ago when I was getting bullied in middle school? I could have used the support then, for crying out loud.
But aren't you just going to get bullied either way? Oh, sorry, yeah. I see what you mean.
I noted that I have found major transcription errors in the scripts, but I didn't find any major blood knocks in those scripts. That's to be expected, as they're Doctor Who scripts and not Goon Show scripts.
I just want to see
your joke.
By the way, while Mary's not there, it did for some reason remind me, listeners, as you know, this show is funded by myself and any people who are happy enough or lucky enough or nice enough, in fact, to donate to the show. And that includes whoone.co.uk, who do make a contribution, but it doesn't cover the complete fee for running the show. Which,
is that whoone.co.uk?
We'll talk about them in a minute. But listeners, if I will tell you now, if each listener, thank you, Robert, if each listener donated a dollar, that would cover our production costs forever. So if you did feel that way inclined, and I hope you do, because it's very nice, I do appreciate it. And obviously, we've already mentioned in the past, thank yous to people, Deanne, who have made quite sizable contributions to the pot. If everybody this week made that $1 contribution, it would cover our production costs forever, because that would be just amazing. I know other podcasts have mentioned this, but it is actually the case. It would cover it.
I was going to say, you do sound like another podcast.
Yeah, but it's true. And then Deb would have nothing to complain about in regards to me funding the show. And you can do that via the Podbean page, by the way. That's the 20 megabyte Doctor Who podcast .podbean.com. Hello, Mary.
And you're not planning on quitting your job and doing this exclusively, are you?
No, not at all. I don't think that's very likely. But it is true, though. A dollar each podcast saved forever. Right then, Mary, who are our sponsors?
Mike and Jerry.
whoone.co.uk.
Correct. Now, we've got latest products.
That's whoone.co.uk.
Latest products are Toby mugs. We've got the Doctor, 8th Doctor, and 9th Doctor. But they look great. They do not look weird. They look well buyable,
No.
Don't they, everybody?
Don't,
don't listen to Robert, listeners.
It's like you're drinking out of their brains. That's what it looks like.
Toby jugs always look like that. Toby mugs, sorry. Not Toby jugs.
Not as,
I was thinking of Nicola Bryan for a second. But, yeah.
Get your tongue back in your mouth, Adam.
Yes.
So there, whoone.co.uk for such things as that, and CDs.
Weird.
CDs of Big Finish and audios and stuff. There's so much stuff there. Go to the website,
www.whoone.co.uk,
where you can buy lots and lots of Doctor Who-related stuff. And that's an Isle of Wight shop, listeners. Yes, an Isle of Wight shop. Right, I think...
It's right down the street, isn't it?
Sorry?
Down the street. Since everything's within a few miles.
And just beyond that is the Rookery Park.
Rookley Park. And it would only take me half an hour to drive to whoone.co.uk. But, of course, finding somewhere to park and ride, it would be a complete nightmare.
Oh, Adam.
Yes.
The podcast just received a $2 donation from me, by the way.
Oh, I've got a lump in my throat. I'm sorry, I've just taken a bite out of a twiglet. No, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Matthew. See, you can do it, listeners. You can do it that quickly. Lovely. Right.
On second thought, that 8th Dr. Mug, his eyes are kind of scary eyes. I don't know that I would like that.
That's what I mean, Mary. They're creepy.
Yeah. Ooh.
So I think it's about time we had. You won't get this one.
Goodbye.
Cue the music.
Okay, you want the music, do you? Oh, good grief. I don't know if I can do that.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
No.
You sure? I'm sure I can find it on here somewhere.
I'm sure we're hearing it anyway.
Well, here we are. I'll play the music. Here we go. I don't know if it'll stop the recording, but here we go. Oh, shut up. Oh, God. That's really... Ow! Blast! Whose idea was it to play the music?
Kirby. Point deducted. Point deducted.
God.
Ah.
Okay. We're recording again. Okay, so this week we have some questions, and I've been a bit more organised this week. In relation to certain items. And
no distractions? No distractions?
Well, no, there'll probably be distractions, but I've been a bit more organised. Right, so, only four people this week, so shall we just say...
Well, I'm going to lose, so...
The winner this week is Matthew.
Terribly.
And thank you for listening to the 20 Megalite.2 podcast.
Welcome, Matthew.
Goodbye.
And to other things.
Well, right. I did just make a donation to the podcast, so I'm sure that has nothing to do with it.
It automatically gives them 2 points.
Okay, right. I'll just get me dinger and me going.
Leave your dinger out of it.
Right. Yeah. Okay, question number one goes to Matthew. Matthew, are you ready? You want to get this one because you always shouted it out earlier on in the review. What was the title of episode one?
The Sea of Death.
Oh.
You all right there, Robert?
No.
Okay. Mary.
Yes.
Where is the Doctor's colour television? I think it's a bit of French that was mentioned during the statement.
I just said somewhere in the TARDIS. I don't know.
Anybody? No.
It's getting repaired or something. It's in a state of something.
Matthew will know. It's something combat, I think.
Yes, it was that actually, but I'm not going to give a point for it.
See, that's a Matthew question. It was you temporarily horse to combat.
Because it's you, Matthew, you'd have to get each word right, I'm afraid. Whore de combat, or something like that. Kirby, you're already on minus one, so you need to get this right to get into the credit, if you like. Where is Ian sure they are not?
Oh, South End. I remember that one.
Well done. All right.
Anytime I hear someone say South End, I think about the buildings washing up and down the shore from Hitchhiker's Guide.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. Robert.
Yes, sir?
What will Ian's boots give Susan? Ian says the boots will
corns,
give...
Corns.
Here's the correct answer. Sort of. That puts you in credit because you were a minus one or two. Right. Right, Matthew.
Yes.
Who does Ian save from the Vord?
Arbitan.
Here's the correct answer. Mary.
Yes.
What is the name of the machine that was the culmination of the planet's technology?
The Conscience of Marinus?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well done. Kirby.
Yes.
Spell Vord.
V-O-O-R-D.
Here's the correct answer. Robert.
How else would it be spelled?
V-O-R-D. V-O-A-R-D. Could be anything, couldn't it? Robert, what happens as soon...
A-N-Y-T-H-I-N-G.
Be quiet.
I would have said V-H-O-O.
Never mind. You're interrupting. You're very close to losing points. Robert, what happens as soon as the Doctor, Susan and Ian depart?
Huh? Depart where? Where from?
Well, it's obviously going to be from the Marinus HQ, isn't it? They get their tiles and they depart. What happens immediately after they've departed? With their little...
They find...
Their travel dials.
Yeah, they find the travel dial of Barbara's, don't they? Because she went on ahead.
Anybody?
I know.
Go on in, Matthew.
Arbiton gets stabbed by a Vord.
Correct. Right, so...
What was the name of the Vord?
Never mind that. Yartek. Hang on, I'm getting pestered by... getting pestered by Isabella. Yes, Isabella.
Can I join in?
Can you join in? How are you going to do that?
Ask the question.
You do like to make my life awkward, don't you? Right, going in.
Yes.
So the scores at the moment, in last place with 1 point is Robert. In third place with 2 points is Mary. In second place with 3 points is Kirby. And then the lead with 5 points.
Hey, Matthew.
Matthew, yes. The microphone's there, Isabella. You're worse than Alicia, I tell you.
Matthew.
The microphone, this thing, microphone. You over there, no picky
didn't
up.
Did Kirby
here.
Have a point deducted?
Yeah, he's had a point deducted. So if he'd not had
the
point deducted...
And he still has three?
Yeah, if he'd not had the point deducted, he'd be in the lead. Right, next.
I'd have four, I think.
Yes, next question...
you would have four, but you had the point deducted.
Yes. Matthew.
Yes.
Right. How did blood end up on Barbara's travel dial?
It scratched her when she took it off.
What a wimp. That much blood from a scratch. Really?
Really.
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Mary.
Yeah.
What does the doctor treat himself to from the banquet?
Oh, I don't remember.
I
pass
know.
It on.
No, go on in, Matthew.
Of course you know.
A pomegranate.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Except he doesn't.
No. no, it was... What was it, Isabella?
And which one was... Which
that one. Shall I say it before we end the podcast?
She got frightened and tried...
What?
No,
no, no. This one. There, look.
Oh. Truffles.
Truffles, yes. Right.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Next question goes to Kirby. Stop jumping up and down, Isabella, please. Okay. Kirby.
The answer is she got frightened from something.
What is the name of the first place the TARDIS crew travel to?
What? So repeat, I'm sorry.
You shouldn't have been talking over the question. Right, moving on. Robert. I'm going to go.
Yes, the others were talking over it, not me.
Oh, I know.
Of course you know. You can see the bloody answer. The microphone's... Oh, for goodness sake. Look, if I put the microphone up there, would you actually get the idea that you're supposed to talk into it? Goodness sake. Shush. Right, sorry. Where'd it go up to, Kirby? Oh, here we go. Your question.
I didn't hear the question.
What is the name of the first place the TARDIS crew travelled to?
Morphaton.
Well done, right. Robert.
I liked that episode. That was the best episode of the whole bunch.
Isabella wants to try and read Robert's question. There we go, Robert. Go on in, Isabella.
What does Susan want to drink for breakfast?
Did you get that?
Drink for breakfast, yeah. I don't really know. I can't remember. Is it a cup of tea?
No, anybody? No, give the answer yet. Anybody?
Some kind of fruit drink?
I'll give you a point for that. It was orange juice. Oh, sorry, what was it, Isabella? Sorry?
The answer was orange juice.
Well done, right. Next question goes to Matthew.
Yes.
What is the name of the Mofotian host? Or Morphotian host. Mm-hmm. When they're on that Morphoton place, what's the name of the host?
Oh, bloody. I can't remember.
Don't swear.
Can I?
Go on in, Robert.
Is it Altos?
Oh!
Man, I'm surprised that Matthew missed that one. Mm. I just can't remember his name.
I wasn't thinking of him as the host.
Well, yeah, I wasn't called. Either. I would have said that.
He
if
was their host, I'm afraid. Mary.
Yes, he was.
Mary.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes.
Does the doctor mistakenly think will help them overcome the fault in the time mechanism on the TARDIS?
Oh, I don't remember.
I know.
What a surprise. Matthew knows.
It's a cup.
I'll give you that one. It was a mug, but yes, I'll be really bad upstanding.
Oh, that's
sorry,
right,
Isabella. Isabella yeah. wanted to give yeah. the answer, mug. And I didn't allow her to do so because I was in full flow. Right, then Kirby.
I thought you wanted what he was calling it, not what it actually was that he was looking at.
No, oh, come on, Kirby. Isabella wants to try and ask this question. Go on, then.
Sure.
He failed to put the disc on Barbara's forehead properly.
Oh, that's easy.
Sabitha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert.
This yes, is horrible. Sir. I'm supposed to be losing.
Robert.
Yes?
How many brain jars does Barbara manage to smash?
No, oh, there's only one. There's only one that I saw smashed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pathetic, wasn't it? Right, after that round of questioning, and last place, or joint last place, Matthew and Mary with... No, that's wrong. Sorry, I got that wrong.
What?
That would be funny, wouldn't that? That would never happen, would it? And Mary yeah. with 3 points. Then Robert with 4 points. In second place with 7 points, Kirby, and then the lead with 8 points, Matthew. Talking of Matthew. Yeah,
Kirby last.
Go on, Matthew. Go on, Isabella. This is Matthew's question.
Who does the doctor decide to try and find when they spilt up?
No, it says split up.
Split up.
Split up.
Split up.
Ephraim.
Here's the correct answer. Right, Mary.
Yes?
You going to ask this one, Isabella?
Yes, I'll try again.
Today be nice.
Why?
No. That one there, look, okay. Where the thing is.
Who looked after discovered keys?
The discovered, that's a the. There, look. The, try again.
Who looked after the discovered keys on a pendant?
Pendant. Yeah, try not to move the microphone while you're talking into it.
We've got pendants in this.
Yes, we have, yes. Okay. Did you get that one, Mary?
I'm a question that looked after. I mean, the one who's safekeeping or the one yes. who took them all?
Yes, who's looking after them, who's safekeeping, yes.
That would be Sabitha.
Yay!
Correct.
Right, Kirby.
Thank you.
Yes.
What is it when... I'll ask this one. Is that all right with you, Isabella?
No, you can go.
Okay. What is it when the whispering starts?
What do you mean, what is it? You mean it's beginning of the next episode.
Yes.
It's the jungle.
Yes.
The jungle.
And a bit of advice was given to somebody in that episode that something... It is something when the whispering starts.
And the death starts.
That's a point deducted for Robert.
What?
Because that was the answer. Right.
It was?
Yeah. But
I was only joking.
You get a point deducted. Right.
What?
But fortunately, it is your go. Ready, Robert?
Yeah.
Where were you? Where is the real micro key?
In that episode, it was in that jar,
yeah,
which was labelled DE302.
Impressive.
Correct.
Yeah, wow. It's a shame you got a point deducted, because that would have whacked your score up quite nicely.
You know what really helps, though?
Yes?
It really helps watching the episode with the subtitles on.
Anyway, Matthew. Oh, actually, should we do the scores? No, we won't do it next round. Isabella, do you want to ask this question?
Which one?
That one.
Okay.
Today.
What is the name of the bearded man in the hut?
Basor?
Yes.
Correct. Ooh.
Mary.
Yes.
Why? Oh, do you go on then, Isabella.
Why was meat left out in the snow with Altos?
Altos.
Altos.
So the wolves would eat him.
Yeah. Right.
Correct.
Go on then, Kirby.
Thank you, Isabella.
Kirby's question.
Kirby just texted me his computer is blue screen, he's rebooting.
Oh, what?
For goodness sake, what timing?
I heard him.
Oh, well, I can come back to that question later. So, Robert?
Yes?
Go on then, that one.
What was used to make a bridge?
Icicles. big icicles.
Correct.
Right. So we can't really do the scores with Kirby being waylaid. Matthew.
Yes.
Who is the first person Ian sees after he wakes up in the vault?
That would be the interrogator guy, Taryn.
Taryn.
Mary. Correct. Do you want to ask Mary's question?
Yeah. What
position?
Position does
Eisen.
Eisen hold.
Yeah, what position does Eisen hold? Or Eosin, or however it was pronounced in the episode.
I don't remember.
Anybody?
No,
I'll say that as a no.
I can't say the word.
The answer was representative of the court.
I wouldn't even know that.
The next one would be Kirby's, but is now in fact Robert's. Go on, yes. Isabella. Don't lock the rim. Order.
Where's it again?
There. Don't read the red text. Go on.
What character did the actress who played Carla go on to play?
That was Lady Painfort in Silver Nemesis.
Correct.
Yes.
Thank you.
I like that.
Oh, right. It's very rewarding to hear that.
Yes, right. So a bonus point for anybody who can, the first to come up with her name or the actress's name.
Fiona Walker.
Too late. Robert got in there first. Right then. So next question, therefore. Oh, I've got a message come up.
Who?
Oh.
Robert.
Rebooting.
Yeah. That was Robert saying, but he's not. Robert's there, aren't you, Robert?
Yes, I'm here.
It's very confusing.
Renewing?
So, yeah.
That's okay.
Questions for Matthew. Go on in, Isabella.
Was it that one?
Yeah.
Who died in the courtroom?
Did you get that?
Yeah, I heard her. Was it Ephraim?
Anybody? Don't touch it.
Can't remember his name.
Okay.
Ephraim's the guy who got murdered.
Go on. Who died in the courtroom, Isabella?
The correct answer was Aiden.
Oh.
Aiden. Oh, yeah.
So, Mary.
Yes.
What is the title of episode 6? Another thingy icons on the right. There you go. Right. What is the title?
The Keys of Marinus.
Yay.
I like those. Thank you, Isabella.
All right. So,
yeah. Very rewarding, isn't
next
it?
Next question would be for Matthew.
Let me do it.
Right, not the red bit. Go on, this is for Matthew.
No,
it's not. It would be for Kirby. It's for Robert. Beg your pardon. Yeah, I think it's gone a bit funny here because I had to redo all the scheduling of the questions. This is for Robert. Go on then, read Robert's question, Isabella.
When is
execution?
Execution due to take place.
Oh, is it when it reaches the star or something?
There's a chance for bonus points when somebody else actually specified it was actually supposed to be. It says later on, I'm garbling myself a little bit, but somebody else said, the execution will be taking place at, and then it was not another sort of version of the same thing, but not saying the words.
Come on, Matthew.
The bonus point.
I have no idea.
Okay, well, the answer was beginning of the next zenith. Beginning of the next zenith.
Wow.
Right, is Kirby back yet?
Yeah.
Me again.
Because all the questions... Kirby's got lots of questions banking up now. Matthew's question now. That one there, it says Robert, is in fact Matthew's question.
Okay, I know.
He's online, it says, so I don't know. Try.
Oh, hang on. Before you ask the question, let's see if we can get Kirby back. Could change the scores completely. Trouble is, I've got to remember where I was when I last asked him the question.
Mary's next, I think, is it?
Matthew.
No, I think it was my question.
Matthew's next, actually.
No, Matthew.
I don't think he's answering.
I knew it was an M name.
Okay, well, let's just go for it then. Actually, there's only three questions left anyway. So, Matthew?
Yes.
Where will Sabitha and Altos go at the end of the story? Don't knock it, please, Lavella.
They go back to the island.
What's it called?
Meredith?
No. Anybody?
Incorrect.
Stop knocking that.
Not South End?
No, it's the city of Melinus. Or Millennius.
Oh, wow. That's right. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right, next question, therefore, would be for Mary. And that is this one, Isabella. One that says 34 next to it.
Okay. Who is the last to enter the TARDIS?
At the end of the story, who's the last one to go into the TARDIS?
Oh, I think it's Barbara. Mm.
Correct.
Oh,
yeah.
Last question goes to Robert. Excellent. Before we wait for Kirby to arrive to ask answer his backlog questions. What is the title of the next episode then, Robert?
What was it?
The Temple
of Evil?
Correct.
Uh-huh. So, at this juncture, let's see what's happened with Kirby. We'll do a little advert, actually. Because my Rolling Stones quiz book's out. So yes, if you like the Rolling Stones, go to Amazon, where you can buy my Rolling Stones quiz book. Or, I don't think it's available on iTunes yet, but so Amazon in the UK, Amazon in the USA, Rolling Stones quiz book, where you can also find the Beatles quiz book.
Give us a chance.
Etc, etc, etc. What do you mean, give you a chance? I've given you a chance. What, to buy my book,
No. Wait. Did I miss all the rest of the quiz?
No, yes, yep. But no. Yep. Yes, but no. We saved your questions for you. Yes. What was the last question you had?
I don't know.
Never mind. Kirby, what was the last question you had? Do you remember?
I don't know.
You don't get a point for the get it right, though. Did you get the question where it said, who failed to put the disc on Barbara's forehead properly? Did you get that one? Right, so your next one therefore would be, what is it when the whispering starts?
I said that was the jungle.
Yeah,
and
so
I've got an echo.
Well, you will have the echo. It's coming out on the speaker. Right, so it's this question then. Ready? Go on, Isabella, you tell him. Ask the question.
What is supposed to be deeper in the mountain?
I'll rephrase the question so it might be a bit easier to understand. What is supposed to be deeper in the mountain? So I'll give you a sort of a clue. I couldn't fit on the line. It's the thing that the bloke in the hut was scared of. And it made him run off.
Those ice warrior kind of things.
But what did he call them?
I don't know.
I know.
I know.
Who said? I think Robert said I know first.
Demons.
Okay. Your next question, Kirby.
Spell it.
No. Kirby?
Yes.
Go on, Isabella.
What?
Don't give the answer, which is that word. Just read it up to the question mark. Thank you.
Okay. What machine was used to check people in and out of the vault?
Did you get that?
I got it. I was paying very little attention to that episode. I don't know.
I know.
Go on in, Matthew.
Psychometric.
Oh, that's right.
It was an auto ray scanner. Yeah. Sorry about that. Nobody got that one. Kirby. Last question. Who was the leader of the Vord?
I don't remember.
I know.
Go on then, Robert.
Yartek.
Correct.
Right then, so the final scores. Ah. I'll write them down so Isabella can actually read them out. In last place... Hang on.
Go on, read it out.
Who's that?
In last place, with 7 points, is Kirby.
And then in third place, go on.
With 11 points, is Mary.
In second place with...
14 points is Matthew.
And the winner this week with...
Oh!
16 is Roberts!
What? Yay, Roberts!
Yeah.
Whoa, I must say that. Wow. Thanks. We'll be right back.
That's astounding, considering he had 2 points deducted as well. So sometimes, Robert, naughtiness does pay off, doesn't it? And thank you, Matthew. One for your donation to the podcast and two for pretending to be rubbish again.
And we all thank Isabella for her wonderful job.
So you have to say that again. I'll turn the speaker off.
Oh, so we want to give a special thank you to Isabella for the wonderful job she did.
Yay.
Thank you.
Yay.
Yes, don't big her up too much. It wasn't that good. Right, I think that's essentially it. Thank you for joining us. What we got? What's the review show for next week? Was it decided? Stones of Blood. That's right. And we already got a review in from Dr. Phil for the Stones of Blood's music, at least. And Cora, have another go. Have a word with Kirby, and we'll sure you get your audio feedback in for next week.
I'm looking forward to the Stones of Blood because I like that entire series.
Yeah, indeed. I haven't watched any Key to Time episodes for a while, so I'm looking forward to it as well. Whether I can fit it in my busy schedule.
In a few weeks.
The what planet?
Mr. Fibulae?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, thanks for joining us this week. Back to the normal time next week, I suspect.
What do you mean by normal time?
Yeah, what is normal?
Yeah, what's normal?
Well, unfortunately, I can't record on Sunday next week because I'll be editing a wedding video, so it does rather leave us back to a slightly earlier Monday start. Sorry.
Okay, standard time.
Standard time, 10 a.m. on Mondays, which is 2 hours from when we started this week. I know, it's terrible, isn't it?
5 a.m. on...
Yes, don't rub it in. Yes, 5 a.m.
Yeah, rub it in,
Kirby. Well, and it's 4 a.m.
4 a.m. for Mary, yes. Thank you, anyway. You don't have to come. Matthew. You don't have to come. It's not compulsory, you know.
No.
It's not?
No, it isn't. No.
What?
No, as it's been proven. As it's been proven, because Kurt Reese isn't here. Anyway.
Yeah.
So until
he warned us that he wouldn't be able to.
Yes, he did. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so until next week, thank you for joining us. And I was going to say something else, actually. What was it now?
I can't remember.
I can't remember either.
Who won Dakota?
No, I said about who won. You disappeared on that one.
No, I know.
Oh, you were there, were you, for that bit? No. No, it's gone. But yes, feedback and stuff, wasn't it? Oh yes, I remember now. Yes, I hope Deanne liked this episode more than she did last week. Anyway,
yes.
So
please,
till next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Woo.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
All the fish. Yeah.
The 20 Megabyte Doctor Who podcast is an APV services podcast. production and is a proud member of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. Doctor Who is a trademark of the BBC. No copyright infringement intended.